Good evening. The Attorney General is one step closer to contempt of Congress.
The question is on the motion to report the committee report for a resolution recommending that the House of Representatives find William F. P. Barr, Attorney General of the United States Department of Justice, in contempt for refusal to comply with a subpoena duly issued by the Committee on the Judiciary as amended favorably to the House.
New sanctions against Iran as the confrontation with the U.S. escalates, and marijuana on the agenda in New York. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Wednesday, May 8, 2019. The House Judiciary Committee voted Wednesday to hold the Attorney General of the United States in contempt. The committee voted 24-16 to hold Barr in contempt after the Justice Department rejected House Democrats' demands for the full Mueller report and the underlying evidence. Ahead of the vote, President Donald Trump asserted executive privilege over those materials and reserved the right to block them. House Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler presented his case at the start of the meeting, called a markup.
Today, we consider a report recommending that the House of Representatives hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for defying a valid subpoena issued by this committee. This is not a step we take lightly. It is the culmination of nearly 3 months of requests, discussions, and negotiations with the Department of Justice for the complete unredacted report by Special Counsel Mueller into Russian interference in the 2016 election, along with the underlying evidence. I appreciate the fact that the department responded to the offer we made to them last week and met with us yesterday in a last-minute effort to reach an accommodation. We heard the department out, we responded to them in good faith, and after all was said and done, we unfortunately were still unable to reach agreement, and we proceeded with our markup today. As I've said before, we remain ready and willing to consider any reasonable offer made by the department even after today's vote. But if a letter I received late last night from the department is any indication, I am concerned that the department is heading in the wrong direction. In response to our latest good faith offer, the department abruptly announced that if we move forward today, it would ask President Trump to invoke what it refers to as a protective assertion of executive privilege on all of the materials subject to our subpoena. Just minutes ago, it took that dramatic step. Besides misapplying the doctrine of executive privilege, since the White House waived these privileges long ago, and the department seemed open to sharing these materials with us just yesterday, this decision represents a clear escalation in the Trump administration's blanket defiance of Congress' constitutionally mandated duties. I hope that the department will think better of this last-minute outburst and return to negotiations. As a co-equal branch of government, we must have access to the materials that we need to fulfill our constitutional responsibilities in a manner consistent with past precedent. This is information we are legally entitled to receive, and we are constitutionally obligated to review. And I would remind the members that the Mueller report is no ordinary run-of-the-mill document. It details significant misconduct involving the president, including his campaign's willingness and eagerness to accept help from a hostile foreign government, numerous misstatements, if not outright lies, concerning those acts, and 11 separate incidents of obstructive behavior by the president that more than 700 former prosecutors have told us warrant criminal indictment. If Congress is not entitled to the full unredacted Mueller report, one must wonder what document we would be entitled to. Our exhaustive negotiations with the Department of Justice have unfortunately left us back where we began, with unprecedented obstruction by an administration that has now announced its intention to block all attempts at congressional oversight of the executive branch. It is our constitutional duty to respond. Let me be clear. The information we are requesting is entirely within our legal rights to receive and is no different than from what has been provided to Congress on numerous occasions going back nearly a century. But we do not need to go back that far to find the precedent. As recently as the last Congress, under Republican control, the Department produced more than 880,000 pages of sensitive investigative materials pertaining to its investigation of Hillary Clinton, as well as voluminous other material relating to the Russia investigation and other ongoing investigations. That production included highly classified material, notes from FBI interviews, internal text messages, and law enforcement memoranda. With respect to grand jury information, in past cases involving allegations of presidential misconduct or misconduct by other high-ranking public officials, the Department of Justice, as a matter of course, has sought the permission of a court to release relevant information to Congress, if not to the public. Notably, this includes several cases that were not impeachment inquiries, including the investigation into former Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy and the Iran-Contra investigations, as well as other investigations that were not governed by the independent counsel law. But no matter the fact that the law and history clearly support the release to Congress of this kind of information, the Trump administration has taken obstruction of Congress to new heights. Unfortunately, the Attorney General has been all too willing to support the President in this endeavor. I would also like to respond to two of the concerns often raised by my good friend, the ranking member. He asks, how can the committee hold the Attorney General in contempt for merely complying with the laws on the books? And how can we hold him in contempt when I have refused an offer to allow me to see certain redacted portions of the report? The answers are simple. First, we issued a valid subpoena for the full report and all of the underlying evidence. The department has come nowhere close to satisfying its obligations under that subpoena. The department has never cited a legal basis for withholding the underlying evidence, including last night's threat to invoke executive privilege, which was utterly without credibility, merit, or legal or factual basis, as is, of course, the assertion of, or the statement that they will assert executive privilege by the White House this morning. To the extent that we have asked for access to grand jury information, which is protected by federal law, all we have ever asked is that the department join us in petitioning the court to determine if it is proper for us to have access to this material. The department, as I said, has done this on many occasions in the past. We asked for a commitment to join us in that effort again last night, as it has done in many previous cases, and the department refused. Second, with respect to the offer to limit, to lift some of the redactions for me and a handful of my colleagues, the department has placed unacceptable limitations on access to that information. Their offer would block the members of this committee from reading those sections of the report for themselves. It would require me to leave my notes behind at the Department of Justice. It would prevent me from speaking with my colleagues, with other members of the committee, about what I might see. What good is it? Of what use can this committee make of information that I have but can't discuss with any other member of the committee? I have consistently stated that if we are to do our jobs as members of the House Judiciary Committee, all of the members require meaningful access to the report and the underlying documents. We need to be able to confer with each other about what we have seen. We need to be able to take official action on what we have seen, if warranted. And if necessary, we need to be able to inform a court of law of what we have learned, even if perhaps under seal. If we can find an accommodation that satisfies those basic principles, I would be happy to continue negotiating with the Department of Justice. But now, by invoking executive privilege on all of the material subject to our subpoena, that process has come to a screeching halt. The administration has announced, loud and clear, that it does not recognize Congress as a co-equal branch of government with independent constitutional oversight authority, and it will continue to wage its campaign of obstruction. When the administration says it will oppose all subpoenas, presumably regardless of its merits, it is saying that it does not recognize Congress having a constitutional oversight authority over the executive branch.
Earlier on Wednesday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi supported the move, saying Barr had lied to Congress under oath about the report by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller into Russian involvement in the 2016 election and an alleged cover-up by Trump. And President Trump sent word he was invoking executive privilege over the unredacted Mueller report and other materials subpoenaed by the House Democrats. The decision was announced by Assistant Attorney General Stephen Boyd in a letter to the House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday morning. Executive privilege is a loosely defined power that allows the president and other executive branch officials to keep information, particularly regarding decision-making deliberations and national security matters, from Congress and the courts. Essentially, lawmakers would have to sue the administration to try to force their release. Attorney and former judge Bill Blum is a columnist for TruthDig.com. He says the country is heading for a constitutional crisis.
The Trump administration isn't turning over any documents connected to the Mueller probe to Congress, and it also means, I take it, that as far as the president's tax returns go, he's not going to turn over anything regarding them either.
What is the implication of that for the way Nadler and Pelosi are talking about it? This has tremendous implications.
It has tremendous implications. We have a federal government of three branches, which are supposed to be co-equal, each one acting as a check on the other. And when you have a president who essentially doesn't want Congress to exercise oversight of the executive branch, you're moving into the terrain of a constitutional crisis, which is a situation where the Constitution doesn't seem to be able to prescribe solutions to resolve conflict between the branches of government. So this is indeed very important, and I don't think that Nadler and Pelosi are particularly enthusiastic about pursuing impeachment, which is the end game of this process. But Trump seems to be defying their authority as a co-equal branch of government and almost asking them to undertake an impeachment proceeding against him.
And what do you think? I mean, the Senate doesn't have, there's no votes in the Senate to impeach. So what's the purpose of bringing impeachment except to make a political statement? What's the legal purpose? And
well,
there could be a legal purpose. I mean, a non-legal, extra-legal purpose as well.
The purpose would be to stand up for the principle that nobody is above the law and that the president has to recognize the authority of Congress to exercise its oversight duties. The Supreme Court has long recognized these oversight duties and the oversight authority. So it's a question of standing up for principle versus political expedience. If one were to weigh in on the scale and vote in favor of expedience, you probably wouldn't want to pursue impeachment because you will lose in the Senate. And the thinking is that a loss in an impeachment trial will redound to Trump's benefit in the 2020 election. I don't know whether that's true or not, and I don't think anyone does. The example of Bill Clinton's impeachment is raised frequently as a hedge against impeaching Trump, because Clinton's popularity rose during the impeachment controversy. But then the effect, it seems to me, was short-lived because Al Gore lost the 2000 election. Now, admittedly, there was great controversy in Florida, but assuming that the impeachment of Bill Clinton redounded to the benefit of not just Clinton personally, but to Democrats generally, the 2000 election shouldn't have been close. So I don't know whether the Clinton analogy will hold up if the House stands by principle and starts impeachment proceedings. In addition, if the House starts impeachment proceedings, I think it's on very, very strong grounds to subpoena and receive the underlying evidence compiled by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, and it will be able, I believe, to compel the testimony of Mueller and Don McGahn, among many others. So this is a matter of principle versus expedience, and it also all depends on how the impeachment hearings are held and how the Senate trial is conducted. Are we going to have a public trial in the well of the Senate? We haven't had that for decades upon decades. Usually the evidentiary phase of the Senate impeachment trial is handled by committees that take depositions, that review records, and then there's a debate on the Senate floor and a vote. But the impeachment of Andrew Johnson involved a full-on trial that lasted many weeks, which would be quite a spectacle and would provide for, in addition to the impeachment hearings themselves in the House, for a full airing of Trump's behavior. So I don't know how it would play out. And that's what makes this so fascinating and so nerve-wracking at the same time.
Attorney and former judge Bill Blum is a columnist for truthdig.com. He says the country is heading for a constitutional crisis. In most instances of a clash between Congress and the White House, the two sides reach some sort of agreement that stops short of litigation. In cases where the branches go to court, the results are not clear. In international news, the U.S. has imposed sweeping new sanctions, escalating the economic blockade of Tehran as the nuclear deal continues to unravel. An executive order signed by President Trump on Wednesday says the property of anyone who owns or operates or engages in significant transactions with Iran's metal sector will be seized by the U.S. under sanctions law. The metal sector include iron, steel, copper, aluminum, and related products. Earlier on Wednesday, Iran announced it would no longer sell excess uranium and heavy water, citing last week's decision by the U.S. to end sanction waivers on these transactions. It was another move by Tehran to back away from the deal that ended its nuclear weapons program after the U.S. scrapped the deal and began tightening the screws on Iran. And polls are closing in South Africa's national election. People who are still in line are able to vote, but counting will now commence. Final results are expected by Saturday. Some 26 million people of South Africa's population of 57 million were eligible to vote, but there have been signs of relatively low turnout. President Cyril Ramaphosa and the ruling African National Congress have faced frustration from voters over corruption scandals and a weak economy with high unemployment. Ramaphosa tells reporters he's truly humbled by the turnout. He says South Africans want to see a country that is working and officials who will work for them. And back in the States, California officials said Wednesday the nation's most productive agricultural state will ban a widely used pesticide blamed for harming brain development in babies. The move, cheered by environmental groups, would outlaw chlorpyrifos after scientists deemed it a toxic air contaminant. It was discovered to be more dangerous than previously thought. It's the first time the state has sought to ban a pesticide. Hawaii banned it last year, and New York lawmakers recently sent a bill to the governor outlawing use of the pesticide. Dow DuPont, which produces the pesticide, said it was disappointed with the decision and that it would hurt farmers who rely on it to control insects. The pesticide is in a class of organophosphates, chemically similar to a nerve gas developed by Nazi Germany before World War II. Its heavy use has left traces in drinking water sources. A University of California at Berkeley study in 2012 found that 87% of umbilical cord blood samples tested from newborn babies contained detectable levels of the pesticide. And over 100 sex workers, activists, and allies converged on Albany Tuesday, calling for the passage of two bills aimed at protecting sex workers from police harassment and clearing their records of crimes traffickers forced them to commit. The trip, part of a recently announced push to decriminalize sex work in New York State, highlighted the newfound willingness of a precarious community to publicly campaign for their rights. Nina Law is an activist for Vocal. She was in Albany on Tuesday.
Yesterday, we had 100 sex workers, trafficking survivors, advocates, and lawyers up to Albany to advocate for two bills that we've been working on. The first is to repeal the loitering for the purposes of the prostitution statute, also commonly known as the Walking While Trans Ban. It allows police to harass, profile, and arrest mostly trans women of color just for standing around, waving at cars, wearing quote-unquote promiscuous clothing, though when you look at the arrest reports, it's often just like tight pants. Even when they're not engaged in actual sex work. And then the second bill we were pushing for is to extend criminal record relief for trafficking survivors. So currently, if you've survived trafficking, you can get prostitution-related statutes wiped from your record. One, we know that many trafficking survivors are actually survivors of labor trafficking. So farming, agricultural work, domestic work, and construction work, those are the top three sectors of labor trafficking. And so they often don't have prostitution-related statutes, but have other records that they need cleared. And then secondly, even if you were a victim of sex trafficking, you can pick up other charges, including trespass, etc. And so we want all survivors of trafficking to not have records for crimes they're forced to commit by the traffickers. So those are the two bills we were discussing in Albany yesterday. We started the morning with a rally around 10:30 a.m. with the legislators who support our coalition and support these bills. And we had folks talk about you know, their ranges of experiences in the sex trade, especially as it relates to these two bills. And so some people spoke about their experiences as migrant sex workers. Some people talked about, you know, being trans women of color and facing so much employment discrimination that they were essentially forced into sex work, not by an individual, but by the larger sort of job market. And other people spoke about the experience of trading sex as a young person who ran away from home or ran away from foster care, and that was what they needed to do to survive. And so we have about a month in the session left, and we're hoping that we can pass at least one of these two bills. They're both pretty narrow and not necessarily related to sex work, and are also pretty uncontroversial. So it's just a matter of making sure legislators understand what these bills are.
And Nina Lau is an activist for Vocal. She was in Albany on Tuesday. And Saturday was the 49th Manual Marijuana Cannabis March and Rally that ended up at Union Square Park. Thousands joined the rally where they heard music and speeches, including a rousing speech by public advocate Jumaane Williams.
What's up, everybody? Legalize it. The mayor said, legalize it. I'm very proud to be here. This is marijuana justice. This is a social justice issue. In fact, marijuana has been legal in some places for a very, very long time. They tried to decriminalize it. It didn't work. It's time for full legalization of marijuana. I shared my story just a few weeks ago. When I was younger for a little bit, I saw a little bit of bud, not for too long, but a couple dimes, a couple nicks. If I was caught, I might not have been an elected official. I might not have been able to get a job. We have to make sure we're honest about what's happening here and why it's happening here. There are communities that get away with this for far too long, and we have to be honest about that. You hear me? So in Albany, I hope they're listening. I think they're trying to sweep this under the rug, but we will not let them do this. We will have full legalization of marijuana in New York State. But all y'all, I need y'all to stay with me on this one too. The only way we're gonna do this is if we expunge all the records of everybody who's been in the criminal justice system associated with marijuana. Seattle did it. They went all the way back to 30 years. We have a quote-unquote Democrat, quote-unquote progressive governor in the office. If he's really progressive, legalizing Governor Cuomo. Expunge the records. And the last part, nobody should make money off marijuana until the communities who have been ravaged by the over-policing and the criminalization of it make money. No one should make money off marijuana until black and brown communities have access to sell the thing that will be legal, that they were arrested for, that they couldn't get jobs for, that they couldn't get student loans for, that will continue to school the prison pipeline for. Are y'all with me?
Yeah.
Are y'all with me?
Yeah.
Everybody say expunge.
Expunge.
Everybody say access to money.
Access to money.
Legalize it. Jumaane Williams, your public advocate, advocating for the public. Peace, everybody.
Public advocate Jumaane Williams. The New York State Legislature is considering the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, the last hope for cannabis legalization this year since it was left out of the state budget. At Saturday's rally, hundreds brazenly lit up joints, spliffs, blunts, water pipes, and bongs as a cloud rose over the rain-slick streets before the sun came out in the afternoon. Folk, punk, and reggae music serenaded as the politicians and activists smoked. It was a sign of how far things have come since the rebellious, unsanctioned marches of past years, when at times hundreds were arrested or ticketed. Of particular interest was the presence of women in large numbers, some who promoted their own fledgling cannabis businesses. The marijuana market in the United States is expected to hit nearly $150 billion by 2025. Recreational use of marijuana is legal in 10 states. Medical use is legal in 33 more. Only 3 states totally prohibit pot. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, May 8th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks for joining us.